Welcome, as always, to our Unusual Whales FOMC panel of experts. It kind of seems like everything in the FOMC landscape of the last 5 or 6 months have been more eventful one after the other than the year prior. And today's kind of no exception to that pattern. So I'm really excited to get some of our panelists' takes today. Now, those of you who have attended these spaces before know I like to keep them wide open for discussion. So feel free to chime in if you have anything to add to another panelist's point. Just give it a little breath of fresh air in between them finishing and you starting, just to help keep any feedback out of the background for our listeners. Now, I'm going to jump right into things here with some panelist introductions, starting off with Joseph Wang. As you know, our go-to Fed guy, headed the trading at the Fed's Open Markets Desk, has a great introductory book I like to plug every single time on central banking called Central Banking 101. And he's the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Unusual Wells. And fellow panelists, great to be back here. I always look forward to these panels.
As do I. I think they're pretty much favorite part of the job. I learn way more than ever every time we come on here. Up next, we've got the last bear standing, rocking an all-new profile picture design, another friend of the spaces. Last Bear is an expert on markets where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack that you should be subscribed to. A lot of really good information coming out of there and macro reads by Last Bear. Welcome back.
Thanks, and I appreciate the plug on the logo. We did a little facelift recently, so I appreciate that. But looking forward to the discussion, and I'm sure it'll be a fun one.
It looks fresh as hell, man. It looks cool. Next, we've got Bob Elliott back, the CIO at Unlimited Funds, the former IC at Bridgewater, and also the PM of ticker HFND. He brings vast knowledge and some breath of fresh air, non-reactionary takes. It seems like it's been forever, even though we had him recently. Bob, I always love having you here. Thanks for coming again.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I feel behind with Last Bear and his nice new logo, and I'm using the same picture from 3 years ago. So gotta get that updated, along with a bunch of new things, including a new fund we launched, HFGM, which is also in something that we're managing that's brand new as well. So look forward to being here. Always great to be on these spaces.
Hey, man, for all the listeners know, that's a brand new picture as of this morning, and you're aging more gracefully than anyone's ever seen, Bob. I think you're beautiful. We will as well, I believe, have one other panelist later on as we kind of get into things. I believe Jem Carson will be on the docket, but we'll keep things pending there. I want to jump right in because we do have a lot to cover before we get to Jerome Powell's presser, and I want to make sure we tickle at least 3/4 of these topics if we can. So to start us off here, I want to get a little framework of some of these topics, starting first with kind of a quick overview question, broadly speaking, starting with GDP here, which unexpectedly shrank by 0.3% in quarter one of 2025, which did catch quite a few analysts a little off guard, but was perhaps expected somewhat by others. Some chalk that up to quirks in trade data and inventory shifts, but many argue that this is too easy, too simple of an explanation, that there are signs of a deeper situation going on, from tariffs to international trusts crumbling in the United States. Joseph, from your point of view, if you don't mind starting us off, what are some of the main factors behind the quarter-over-quarter shrinking in GDP, and how can we expect to see things shift on the horizon?
Well, first off, that was a great summary. Like you noted, we did have a negative GDP print for the quarter, but then I think it's not something we really need to panic just yet. Like you mentioned, a lot of that seems to be driven by a surge in imports. The way GDP is calculated, when you have a surge in imports, that subtracts from growth, because that's being money being spent. That's not being spent within the country. It's being spent on businesses outside. And so the way that this is calculated, it's basically based on expenditures. However, when you look at, let's say, what some people think of as core GDP, that is final sales to private to the private sector, you'll notice that it was growing at about 3% annual rate. So that shows that at least before Liberation Day, we did have a solid economy before Liberation Day. Now, between then and now, a lot of things have happened. I think it definitely makes sense for there to be more economic weakness, not necessarily because of, you know, what's all this stuff happening with trade, but just because that, because there's no clarity as to what the tariffs would be and how progress on the fiscal package would be. Everyone is probably just standing by and waiting. And so that process is probably going to suggest at least some weakening in economic activity. And to be clear, we see some of that in the data as well.
Kind of tying into what Joseph was saying, at the same time as this, we are seeing a noticeable hit taken by real consumer spending, and overall consumer confidence has also seemingly been slipping month over month. So would you say that based on this alone, are households more spooked by inflation sticking around, which we'll get to a little later as well, tariffs, or they're just too myriad factors making it too hard to pinpoint a direct cause? Lasbir, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think there's definitely a headline shock sort of effect happening, which obviously shows up in all of the soft data, the sort of sentiment surveys, even business leader surveys, that sort of thing, which have been by far the worst looking data points that we've seen. But obviously taken with a grain of salt, given that they are sort of subject to a human reaction function. And so I think that there is an element of uncertainty for sure, both across businesses and consumers as to what's going to happen with the tariffs, what was happening with the market this past month. And it's possible that you also see some front running of tariffs. I think that there is evidence of that in certain areas, like auto sales were very strong in the first quarter, and seemed to have fallen off a little bit after that. Maybe you have some pull forward in other categories. I think it's really hard to sort of differentiate between what's normal consumption and what might be sort of a reaction to what's happening going on more broadly. But I do think that that there is uncertainty that's going to continue, especially to the extent that some of these trade impacts start to really show up more tangibly. I think we've been in a period where it's been mostly headlines, and we haven't really seen a lot of tangible effects. So, for example, you know, the 145 tariffs on China, those goods are just starting to arrive without under that tariff rate right now. And tariffs get paid as they, you know, as products are taken off the port here stateside. So we're really only starting to see the early effects of these, you know, the effect on imports, the effect on exports. There's been a huge drop off in, you know, agricultural exports to China, as an example. And I think that as that moves forward, it'll translate from more of a soft data type survey reaction, maybe a little bit of you know, return to the mean in terms of people's expectations, which really were quite extreme, I think, coming out of you know, some of the big announcements that we had from the White House over the past couple of months. Maybe a little bit of reversion on sort of the soft data, but showing up a little bit more in the hard data. So that's what I'm looking forward going forward.
Thank you, Lasbir. Now next I'm gonna pick on our man, the urban cowboy himself, Michael Cow, the chief investment officer and portfolio manager of Cow Family Office and an expert in commodities, convertible and capital structure arbitrage, and dynamic hedging. Always love having you here, Michael, and I'm going to pick that beautiful brain of yours now with kind of a tie-on to what Bob and Joseph were saying. I just wanted to bring up the University of Michigan here, whose sentiment reading dropped to 50.8 in April, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the lowest we've seen since early on in the COVID pandemic. Now, kind of a two-parter here. How much weight should we actually give to that sentiment in forecasting where the economy's headed? And do you kind of agree with what some of the panelists have said so far, that some of these reactions might be a little bit news headline-driven?
Hey, thanks for having me again. It's great to be back on this panel. So I'm glad you brought up sentiment, because one of the things that I wanted to mention is that I see right now the macro environment, I think, is clouded by two primary biases. One is political bias, and the other one is what I'll just call home sector bias. Now, with respect to political bias, a couple of weeks ago, I posted a chart that I borrowed from my macro analyst friend Lakshmi that showed the University of Michigan sentiment index by political affiliation, as well as the University of Michigan inflation expectations by political affiliation. And I found this absolutely fascinating because if you're a Democrat, you had a very, very negative view on sentiment on the economy, and a very high view of forward inflation expectations. And then if you're Republican, the expectations were exactly the opposite. Now, I just find that really, really interesting. And I really think that when you try to cut through this political bias, the truth is going to settle in somewhere right dead smack in the middle, somewhere right in between. So I take some of those sentiment indices with a huge grain of salt, and I think you have to look through that. And with respect to what Last Bear was saying in terms of the hard data, so I've been really thinking about the tariff impact on recession, because that's obviously the big front and center boogeyman. And, you know, I feel like I'm in the minority these days where I actually think that we'll probably avoid a recession, at least from tariffs, because, you know, about three quarters of US GDP is services. And I estimate maybe only about 10 to 15% of US GDP to be directly exposed to tariffs, you know, manufacturing, retail, a little bit of ag and mining. So this is where I talk about this home sector bias, because, you know, you hear these podcasts and interviews with people, for instance, like the CEO of Flexport recently said that, you know, an asteroid is going to hit the U.S. economy with, you know, all mass bankruptcies, blah, blah, blah. But again, that part of the economy, what we're dealing with here is it's not like a heart attack that COVID presented. This is more like a hiccup, and the hiccup can go away with some steady breathing and doesn't require a major defibrillation. Now, where I am more legitimately concerned about the economy are sort of factors that were in existence before the tariffs, meaning, you know, we've definitely had a reduced fiscal impulse with the incoming Trump administration, right? And even though I know everybody's disappointed at the Doge numbers, but the point here is that the Doge numbers actually, the fact that Doge actually cut is saying something. And then the other thing is, you know, so there's a reduced fiscal impulse, and then there is also the consumer exhaustion from all of the COVID stimulus, right? And also, of course, the U.S. economy sports the highest real rates of the G10. So those preordained, or sort of pre-existing, I meant to say, pre-existing factors are the bigger concerns. I don't think tariffs alone are going to put us into recession.
Thank you, Michael. So I actually want to kick one of these around the panel here. Now, politics set aside, looking a little bit more at some information that we do have that are, by most economists' points of view, directly tied to tariffs and possibly the trade war sparking, and that being the threat to supply chains amidst this tariff uncertainty. Now, indeed, we have already seen some signs of this, especially with China. Some of those projections as high as 35% of shipments to the West Coast, for example, to drop off, and container bookings from China to the U.S. falling 45% year over year. A lot of that happening, not necessarily since Liberation Day specifically, but since the tariff announcements and the pushback that came from it began. What sort of effects do we expect to see from this, especially if shipments fall even further? And is this a good indication of, like I kind of tickled at the beginning of this little spiel, is this an indication of direct effect from tariffs specifically? I do want the whole panel on this one, but let's start with Bob here.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges that we're looking at right now is essentially we've set up an embargo on Chinese goods. And in the short term, you know, basically everyone has at least some stock on the shelves that they can absorb it. And so if it were to reverse, you know, in the next month or two, probably there wouldn't be significant macroeconomic consequences. I think the real question is, if some form of the embargo remains in place, how magnified is that impact? Of course, imports from China are a few percent of our GDP. In and of itself, you know, probably not that big a deal if you were just talking about, you know, the imports. The real question is, where do those imports fit in to all of the goods related and to some extent services related activities that happen in the economy? And, you know, the reality is, what, something like one third of the economy is some sort of direct or indirect goods related consumption. And pretty much there isn't a place in the economy that isn't influenced or isn't supplied by Chinese goods in one form or another. And so I think of, you know, my kid's soap, which is made in America, but is the bottle is produced in China, is such a perfect example of, you know, the type of stresses that lots of companies are facing, even things that are quote unquote made domestically. And so, you know, the thing I would emphasize is we have no idea. In the same way, when we were standing in March 1st of 2020, we had no idea of all of the second and third order consequences of, you know, turning off the economy the way that we did. We don't have a full appreciation, and nobody does, of all the different ways in which an embargo will disrupt activity throughout the economy and the services and goods sector. And so the main thing is, like, the direction, and I'd say at the same time, the direction is pretty clear, which is, if this sticks around, it's going to be a negative. And if it's a negative compared to equity markets in particular that are pricing in very, very optimistic conditions, you know, any persistence of the tariff environment or the Chinese embargo will, you know, is set up to disappoint very, very elevated equity expectations. And so that's, you know, a lot of uncertainty in terms of the macroeconomic consequences. But actually, when it comes to the markets, a lot less uncertainty, because the markets have basically fully priced in a full-scale rollback of the tariffs. And, you know, the range of outcomes are certainly include that, but they also include a reasonable possibility that they stick around for a while.
So I want to kick this one around the panel, like I mentioned, and to your point there, Bob, about, you know, not quite knowing exactly what'll happen amidst an embargo. I think the only example I have that comes to mind is the Embargo Act of 1807, and I would argue the world's a little more intertwined than it was back then. Michael, I see your hand, and then we can keep this thing rolling around the panel.
Perfect. I wanted to chime in on some of Bob's thoughts here. So I totally agree that I think the market has priced in a lack of persistence of any of these tariffs, and I think that's where the market is going to get disappointed. For the last month, I've been thinking about this tariff strategy through a geopolitical and economic statecraft lens, and I think that I broadly classify tariffs into two categories: what I call long-term incentive modifiers and short-term negotiation tools. And you know, this is what I would be advising the administration if I were in that seat, saying that there are critical path industries like chips, ships, drugs, critical minerals, energy, that need to have persistent tariffs, and perhaps they need to even be set at embargo rates like 40-50% to incentivize long-term behavioral modification. You know, maybe there's a ratcheting mechanism. And then there are the reciprocal and the punitive escalatory tariffs of like the 145% tariffs on stuff like what I call t-shirts and tchotchkes. And I think that those ultimately will get negotiated down to possibly zero. And so this is my wish list for what the administration will do from a long-term geopolitical perspective. And for the first time yesterday, Scott Bessent indicated that that's exactly where they're thinking. He made some comments yesterday on the eve of the upcoming talks with China, saying that you know, we don't need to necessarily decouple in areas like textiles and such, but there are other critical industries where we do need to decouple. And that's exactly what I've been anticipating over the last several weeks. So I think that that's something to watch out for. And there will be, there definitely will be some impacts on the market and the economy in those sectors.
Thank you, Michael. So just for the panel here, and we're joined by Kai Volatility, leading volatility expert Jem Karsan as well. And I'm going to throw him straight to the wolves here if he's caught up enough. To what Michael said here and to some of Bob's points as well, is this considered a negotiating tactic, or are we seeing a real shift toward decoupling the U.S. from the world abroad? The IMF, for example, has said that the tariff situation threatens the very stability of the global markets. And I'm wondering for your point of view, Jem, just how accurate is that?
Look, people forget that Donald Trump has been talking about this since 1980. This is not, everybody paints this as like, this is just a political thing that he's doing. Yes, it is, by the way, the number one thing that has drawn people to him and why he has become a vehicle for the populism that has come to us at this point of the cycle. But the tariff thing is not something he just came up with. And by the way, like, you know, we have shipped our jobs abroad. That's what monetary policy is, sending all the money to the top, to the corporations. Corporations are profit seeking. They look, you know, water flows to the lowest point and finds the cheapest labor. That's how the system works. But no matter what you think about Donald Trump, one thing he has been consistent about for 45 years is the need to make things more in America and to not ship our stuff abroad. And so, no, I don't think this is a negotiating tactic. Yes, the art of the deal is part of who he is. And yes, you know, there are always, you know, a big chunk of what he does is not necessarily exactly what's going to happen. But I think if you're confusing that the whole tariff thing is just a ploy to get extract concessions and then move on, I think you're playing the wrong hand. Importantly, outside of just who he is and what he believes in, you know, we could talk about whether he's principled or not, but you have to understand popular. We are in a very populist time. We have talked about that on here for 3 years. If people don't see it by now, who have been listening to us here on the spaces, you're missing the big picture. And you saw this, by the way, the Trump administration came in with two sides. It came in with Elon Musk. I would say Bessent tangentially connected to Elon Musk, and basically corporate America, basically arguing supply side economics is the way out of this mess, which is, by the way, you know, if there weren't human beings in the system, that's right. There weren't voters, that's right. And then you have the core Trump, the Navarros, the Lutnick, you know, that side, and the Bannons and everybody else, everybody from Trump 1.0. Who brought him politically, who made him politically popular, who got him to where he is, right? Arguing for tariffs and protectionism and populism. Those two concepts were always in complete contradiction to each other and were unsustainable together. And it took about, by the way, when everybody was like, well, no, they're going to cut, you know, spending at the bottom, and they're going to, you know, get a Fed response, and they're going to do a big tax cuts for corporations, and we're all going to go back to 2010, to 2020, 2021. And my answer was, okay, good luck. Like, that's not going to happen because politically it is unpalatable. And what happened in the first 100 days? Exactly that. They tried to signal those things. They tried to slow and pull through both Doge and through all of the cuts to SNAP payments and Medicare and all the proposed budget things. They tried to cut spending. and are trying to do supply side economics. You know how that ended up? That ended up with, you know, bonfires at at Musk dealership, you know, Tesla dealerships, and Elon and Besant yelling in the hallways of the White House. It's a political nightmare, and his post his 100-day kind of approval rating is the worst of any presidents in World War II. And that's why you're getting the pivot, and that's why you're getting a move back to his base, which is populist, and his core principles. So my view is, no, this is not going away. They will try and make, quote unquote, progress. They will try and support markets and do what they can, but they are not getting the support from the Fed and monetary policy. They're backing away from spending, by the way, is above what it has been the last 4 years for the first 100 days. It's higher than it's been, period. So you know, you can listen to what they're saying, but I think to misjudge this as just a negotiation would be incorrect.
Fair enough, Jim. A lot to unpack there as well. Joseph, do you have any responses or anything to add to some of Jim's points there?
No, I agree with Jim. If you look at, I mean, if you can go Google a front page ad Trump wrote in the New York Times in 1987, and he's talking about, you know, these countries are ripping us off. They don't pay their fair share. We protect them. Basically, exactly the same things he's saying today. Like he hasn't changed. But I think there is a legitimate problem here too, because if you zoom out and you look at the goods trade deficit of the United States, it's growing and growing. And right now it's over $1 trillion. That means the United States is buying more than it sells to other countries. And that difference is $1 trillion. So it's a very large goods trade deficit. Zooming out, looking across the world, China has a goods trade surplus with the rest of the world, not bilateral with the US, but with the rest of the world, of over $1 trillion. So basically you have a country, the United States, is just consuming too much stuff, particularly from abroad. And you have another country that's just producing too much stuff and selling it abroad. So this is a very legitimate global imbalance. And I think many people would like to solve that. The way that President Trump is approaching this is, as Bob described it, as a trade embargo with China. And it is kind of a cold turkey thing. So it is pretty extreme. But I think on top of that, they're also trying to add tax incentives to encourage domestic production, deregulation and things like that, and getting oil prices down. So it's part of an effort to just reshore industry. Part of it is for national security reasons. Like Michael mentioned, we need to be able to produce our own steel, aluminum, and military sensitive technologies, pharmaceuticals, and so forth. So I think at the end of the day, what we're going to see is just tariffs, about 10% tariffs on everyone in the world, and probably 50 to 60% tariffs on China. That's what President Trump mentioned on the campaign trail a year ago. And that's, I think, what we're gradually moving towards. So this is definitely something that's structural. Don't seem like the market is understanding this, but then the market didn't really understand Liberation Day either. I think many of the people on this panel were telling everyone that, you know, President Trump's the real deal. He's going to do something. And I think many of us were proven correct on that day. It's kind of a strange thing to see in the market. I noticed that yesterday when President Trump was giving a news conference, he was teasing everyone that there's going to be this huge, huge, huge announcement. Maybe you've never seen anything like this before. It's going to be the best in the world. And the market popped on that. But the last time he said something like that, that was Liberation Day. So I don't know if that's the right approach for that. So this is something that's a big change in the world. And one other thing that I'd add is that if you look at the staff in the Trump administration, you have Peter Navarro, who, of course, is a famous China hawk, wrote a book titled Death by China. You have U.S. Trade Representative Jimmy Greer. He talks about decoupling with China. So this is a structural regime change in how the world works. And so I think the future is definitely not going to be like the past. Hopefully everyone is aware of that.
Thank you, Joseph. And kind of as just like a little tie-in on this, just more specifically between the U.S. and Canada, real quick here. Just this week, there was a pretty tense exchange with Prime Minister Mark Carney and Trump, floating that idea of renegotiating the USMCA terms. And then, of course, there was the typical joke about Canada becoming a state, which was quickly rebuffed. But I'm wondering, with these types of potential negotiations happening on what was a long-standing strong trade agreement between the U.S., Canada, Mexico that changed slightly during Trump's last administration, now looking at renegotiating again. How do situations like this affect investor confidence in NAFTA successor agreements? Les Baer, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so maybe just quickly before that, I just wanted to add a couple points to the prior discussion, just around the shipping element. So I think actually I've been spending a lot of time trying to separate hyperbole from data in terms of what's actually happening with import volumes, what's happening with data coming from China. I think one guy who I'd encourage people to follow, I believe his name is Sal. He has a YouTube channel called What's Going On With Shipping. He has really good, solid data-based approach to this, and he puts out regular updates, and I think he's been a great resource, so I wanted to plug him. But if you look at the actual container ship volumes out of China, obviously they sort of fell off a cliff from March or from, you know, early April, but that was a very elevated level. And if you actually, you know, Bloomberg has a departures, has a couple tickers that sort of track this. And if you look back, it's actually at the same level that it was in sort of early 2023, which granted was the low point in sort of the goods cycle. And so it's, you know, a big step down from 2024 levels. But it's not going to zero. And it's, you know, obviously there's exemptions to tariffs. There's sort of washing of tariffs by, trying to say that things are from different countries and trying to get around those sort of regulations. There are going to be shipments that have to come regardless because they're essential components. There are, you know, some amount of containers that might just come and sit and dwell at the port of Los Angeles, and if they don't, if tariffs aren't paid, then they'll sit there and clog up the port. So I think that the situation with shipping is more complicated than just it went from 100 to zero and it's at zero. It's not the case right now, but that's not to say that it isn't a big issue that's going to persist going forward. And I think as the time is really the compounding factor here. So the longer that this lasts, the longer you have disruptions to the supply chain dynamics, you know, physical supply chain dynamics, like where are the containers? Is, you know, we saw the stuff back in COVID. We might get, you know, another lesson in those in the coming months, depending on what happens. And I do think, just then moving to your next question around North America, it is interesting that I think that, you know, obviously some of the original tariff announcements were focused on our immediate neighbors, Canada and Mexico. And then since then, seems like we've shifted that, or the White House has shifted that perspective towards viewing North America maybe as a more of a free trade block relatively, and focusing more on external trade from Asia and Europe. And if you think about, I mean, just adding in the geopolitical layer, it's interesting that Trump is talking about Canada potentially joining what emerging the artificial lines with Canada, Greenland, talking about potentially taking Greenland by force, something that, you know, you would never expect to hear a president say in any sort of open way. And then all the way down to the Panama Canal and the Gulf of America, it seems that Trump very much has a view of the North American continent, I think, is sort of where his eyes are set on, if you want to put like a triangle around it, you know, from Alaska to Greenland to the Panama Canal. And obviously, there's a lot of opinions on that and geopolitical considerations with that. But I think from a strategic lens, at least the current White House is sort of viewing this as sort of an economic block. So it'll be interesting to see how companies navigate sort of the Canada-Mexico dynamic, potentially seeking to avoid harsher tariffs from overseas by sort of having more activity flow through those countries. But I think if you think about it from a broader geopolitical lens, there is potentially an alignment around North America versus the rest of the world.
Thank you, Les Baer. Michael, comments before I pick on Bob and then spin us to monetary policy.
Yeah, I just wanted to spend a couple minutes on geopolitics and economic statecraft as well. So I think that I totally agree with Les Baer on the North America block. About a month ago, I had a podcast with Michael Every, who's the global strategist at Rabobank. And we talked about how the the end economic statecraft goal was to create a sort of closed loop North America block, you know, with, you know, despite all the hostile rhetoric between Trump and then Prime Minister Trudeau, I think ultimately realpolitik is going to win the day here. And I think the North America block is something that will happen eventually. The other thing I'll add is that I've been warning a lot of my retailer CEO friends that where, you know, everybody's scrambling to move their supply chains out of China. But I think it makes a big difference as to where people move, because I think Trump 2.0 is very serious about economic isolation of China and closing the loopholes, not just transshipment loopholes, but also like trans manufacturing loopholes. So, you know, countries, for instance, like Cambodia, Laos, that tend to be historically China aligned, you know, I call it the, you know, out of the frying pan and into the fire risk. So, you know, if you're a retailer moving into some of these other countries, you have to be very, very careful, because you may find those loopholes shut. So, yeah.
Thank you, Michael. So the last thing that I want to touch on this, and I do want to get to the Fed monetary policy rather and strategy. It's been mentioned before on the panel today, just this week, Trump said that the U.S., quote, doesn't have to sign any deals with China. And prior to today, when Bessent said that, I think Sunday is going to be when the Chinese-American negotiations begin. Prior to then, there was, you know, no confirmation from the White House of any negotiations. But that notwithstanding, Bob, you recently posted that China's latest policy shift keeps pumping the supply of credit when demand remains the problem. And you went on to say better than nothing to cushion trade war drag, but far from the big bang that's needed. Can you kind of talk us through this one, Bob? What is that big bang that is needed?
Well, I think the Chinese situation in many ways has not really changed for, I mean, several years now. I mean, really not since the post-COVID situation where, you know, you have a private sector, and particularly a housing market, that's taken on far too much debt, you know, drove both activity and prices to unsustainable levels, and where, you know, there are significant overcapacity and losses in the system that have yet to be recognized. And the question then, you know, faced with essentially a structural over indebtedness and credit problem, is how do you deal with that problem? And the Chinese have sort of consistently struggled, I'd say, to apply a set of policies that would really resolve the issue. If you remember, I mean, essentially the US faced the same thing in 2008. What did we do? We recapitalized the banks, you know, double what they needed, and stimulated, you know, private sector consumption, and printed a shit ton of money. And you look at what China's doing, and, you know, most of what they're doing is on the supply side. So even today, you know, cutting repo rates by 10 basis points or something, you know, cutting the reserve requirement by 50 basis points. You know, if there were issues where the supply of credit was a problem, then, you know, those things could possibly matter. They talk about freeing up a trillion yuan of capacity. But the supply of credit in China is not a problem. If you want to borrow, you know, you can borrow all you want. Particularly, you can borrow all you want if you're on a, you know, a prioritized industry. The problem right now is that no one wants to borrow, no one wants to invest, and no one wants to buy assets because they're all depreciating in value. And so faced with that circumstance, what they need to do to sort of tactically to manage the debt situation and then structurally to manage the debt situation is that they have to figure out a way to stimulate domestic consumption rather than, you know, lean even further into more manufacturing and, you know, more bigger surpluses. And so, you know, the interesting thing in the context of all of these international strategic, you know, geopolitical issues is honestly the best thing from a negotiation standpoint that the U.S. should do is they should sit down and say, hey, why don't you engage in a 5% of GDP set of stimulus checks to consumers? That would radically change the picture. Why don't you clean up your banks and recapitalize them? Why don't you, you know, restructure the debts of all the over-indebted private sector entities? Those would be the things that could unleash a surge in Chinese demand that would both address the structural imbalances, spending versus savings imbalances, or spending versus manufacturing imbalances, and also would deal with the longer-term debt problem. But for some reason, and I say that with an open mind, there is certainly some reason why the Chinese policymakers are choosing not to do that. I think, you know, you could probably speculate on why that might be, but they aren't. And instead, what they're doing is sort of doubling down on all these supply side dynamics, which, you know, you can pump the hell out of the supply side and on the margin, it'll make things better than they would be otherwise. And on the margin, it'll, you know, help cushion the trade problems. But it's not going to deal with the international problem of the structural rebalancing that needs to happen to satisfy, you know, their trade partners. And it certainly is not going to deal with the malaise, let's say, that the Chinese have faced over the last 5 years.
Thank you, Bob. Michael, did you have something to add to that before I move us along?
Yeah, I shared something in the Nest just now that directly addresses this issue. I think the fundamental problem with China is that they have a top-down investment-led GDP targeting economic model that for 40 years has revolved around the real estate industry. And as we all know, that jig is up. You know, they've got 100 million unoccupied housing units, another 100 million or so in various states of incompletion. So call it 200 million unoccupied housing units. I mean, China could solve the world's homeless problem if they had, if only they had immigration, right? But anyway, that jig is up. And so the CCP Eye of Sauron has changed its focus to industrial capacity, especially as of 10 years ago and in critical path industries. The problem here is what I call this runaway assembly line syndrome, where you know, they need to churn out goods regardless of regular economic supply demand signals. This is not the type of globalization that's based on comparative advantage. And to Bob's point about them not transitioning to a consumer economy, I highlight in the Nest this thread that Michael Pettis wrote this morning, which I totally agree with, because I call it, you know, this is their issue is that if they actually transition to a consumer economy, it would cannibalize their existing top-down economic model. And it's kind of like a sovereign level innovator's dilemma problem. So I think they're fundamentally stuck. And that explains why all these years of like Chinese bazooka stimmies have been nothing more than what I call lipstick on a pig stimulus measures to maybe, you know, gin up stocks, but they're not addressing the fundamental problem that China has.
Thank you for the additional context, Michael. Now here we've got about 17 minutes before we get some data. So I really want us to take this time to talk about monetary policy, the Fed strategy, and a little bit more on the subject of inflation itself. Now, starting off with this, the Fed last held rates steady despite slightly weaker GDP and the falling confidence we discussed earlier at the last FOMC. And it's, you know, it's pretty highly anticipated the same thing will happen again today, which some read as a sign that the Fed thinks things are under control. Mohamed El-Erian, on the other hand, recently said the Fed seems to be boxed in, risking either looking too slow or too reactive. So I'm going to start with Joseph on this one and then kick it to Jem, and then panel, please feel free to chime in after that. Do you agree with El-Erian that the Fed is out of room to maneuver, or are things indeed under control currently? Do we anticipate some semi-linear path forward from here?
So I don't actually think it's that hard for policy at the moment. But anyway, as I understand today, Jay Powell will just show up and flip a coin and then he'll decide what to do. But in any case, so right now on the FOMC, you have two camps, right? You have one camp, I think that's probably more in line with how Mohammed thinks, and that is that you have inflation expectations. So the economy is weakening. We have slower GDP growth. The labor market is softening. But at the same time, you have inflation expectations rising for certain groups of people, as you noted earlier, Nick. So this is a problem because the central bank is worried that, let's say, that they try to address the economic weakness by cutting rates, then potentially they can risk inflation getting out of hand because inflation expectations are higher. So Chair Powell has emphasized that he's going to try to keep inflation expectations anchored. And so he's basically committing today to being late by just sitting down and watching the data and not doing anything until he actually sees breakdowns in the data. And that's not in line with how he usually acts. Last year, for example, he did act preemptively and cut 50 basis points. So instead of being ahead, he's committing to being behind, trying to address this fear of inflation being rekindled due to high expectations. But there are also others on the FOMC led by Governor Waller, who thinks that, you know, we should cut if we see economic weakness, particularly when it comes to the labor market, because, you know, if we have tariffs, yes, prices could go up, but it's not a change in the rate of change. It's just a change in the price level. So we could have, let's say, a one-time increase in the level of prices, say a few percent, but then that doesn't mean that next year we'd also see a similarly large change in prices. So it's a jump in the level rather than the rate of change. And in that case, you would just cut when you see economic weakness. So I actually think that Governor Waller is more correct when it comes to this, because the inflationary impacts on tariffs, that seems to be, as Michael noted before, there's a lot of politicization in this. So going forward, if, let's say, tariffs raise prices, what happened the first time around was that the businesses absorb that with high margins, and business profit margins are historically on the higher side now, so that continues to be possible. But even if it were to be passed down, at the end of the day, if you look at how our inflation indexes are constructed, goods is not a very big part of it. It's mostly services. And as the economy weakens, as unemployment rises, you already see that the wage inflation is declining. And so that's going to moderate against the increase in goods. So I personally am not concerned about inflation this year. And so if you have economic weakness, even though I understand that there are people who are panicking about higher inflation, these sentiment things can change very quickly. We see oil coming down, for example. And as oil comes down, crack spreads staying constant, you're going to see gasoline prices come down as well. So that should address a lot of the inflation expectation concerns. So I think it's kind of, if I were the Fed, I would just cut when I see economic weakness, and it would be reasonable to me. It would not be unreasonable to do that really soon, since we do see weakness. But politics affects consumers. It also affects Fed members too, I imagine. So maybe they are legitimately or honestly concerned about expectations getting out of hand. Maybe they are afraid themselves.
Thank you, Joseph. Jim.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I disagree with Joseph, but I'm actually going to disagree with him for the first time in forever. We usually agree about everything. Look, I think if you look at how this started, when the Trump administration came in, as I mentioned before, there was this debate as to whether they were going to run at least somewhat supply side policy to help counteract the protectionist policy they were talking about, and to try and bring the 10-year down and get inflation down, right? That was their focus. And by the way, correctly so, that needs to be the focus for all parties involved at this point. We can debate whether or not tariffs decrease economic activity in the US. That I'm not so convinced about. That is a more of a take from the rich, give to the poor take from corporations, give to individuals situation over the medium term. But what we can't, I don't think that there's much debate as to whether or not tariffs are inflationary, right? Like you can't take the cheapest producer of goods in the world and cut them off from one of the most expensive producers of goods in the world and expect there to be no inflation. I think what we've seen, what we've seen for 4 or 5 years that we've all talked about here is that that stickiness to inflation that was driven by, demand side, a move to more protectionist populist policies, more fiscal spending, more protectionism, et cetera. And at every turn, we've had transitory 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. At this point, at every turn, inflation has been higher than expected. And in, under this administration, the tariffs are a massive escalation of that populism. The question was, were they going to do some other supply side economics? Were they going to cut, SNAP payments, all these other things and the budget? Well, that was potentially going to happen as of a month and a half ago. Look at where the budget is now. We're eliminating taxes on tips now. I want to reiterate, eliminating all taxes on tips. I don't think enough people talk about that. That is fiscal spending on steroids. We are increasing the defense budget. We were talking about cutting it. We're increasing it by $150 billion this year. We are way above spending where it was before, and we were already running hot. So spending is up. We are cutting cheap supply of goods from abroad. Under what scenario is this not inflationary? I think to go back to the mental model, Joseph, that we are back in a recession is coming. So that 10-year will come down and cyclically it's going to slow inflation. I think the focus on a recession here is the can we go into recession? Yes. Will it likely be mild if we have it unless the market absolutely collapses? Yes. And why will it be mild? Because we're taking from the top 10%, which has been 50% of retail spending, and forcing it down to the bottom. By the way, not a surprise that the employment numbers were hotter than expected. At every turn, they've been hotter. Protectionism and populism means that you actually don't get hurt on the jobs front as much as people think. Guess what? If we make America great again, we're going to bring jobs back. They may be low-paying jobs. They may benefit the bottom 20, 30, 40%. But employment is not the problem here. We're going to have more jobs than we need to fill because we're taking them from abroad. It's the distribution of income. And that's the problem. And that's inflationary. And that's why we are where we are. So I completely disagree. Can like a slowdown caused by uncertainty and maybe a wealth effect where the market comes down drive a recession like 69, 70? Yes, it can. But as a mild recession, the 10-year will not come down. Inflation will not come down. The curve will steepen. And if the Fed stimulates, which it eventually will, inflation will take off. That's my opinion.
Now, to that point a bit, inflation, I think, currently running at about 2.4% or just under, but some projections do have it pushing back above 3% by the end of the year. And so I wonder, Joseph, if you'd also like to respond here, and I do see Michael's hand, so we'll start with Michael. Is the Fed underestimating how sticky price pressures might get as we move into the summer and the fall?
So, usually I agree with both Jen and Joseph, but this time I think I side with Joseph here. I'm of the opinion that, well, number one, with respect to tariffs, yes, you will have a price shock, but I think what people are also underestimating is the demand destruction that comes with the price shock. And especially when you look at edge cases like, the 145% tariffs, I think everybody agrees that those are embargo levels. Well, what happens if you take it to 500%? It doesn't matter, right? Because volume goes to zero. So ultimately, I think that there's a big demand destructive element. You might probably have a surge of inflation in the beginning. And it also depends on, if you go back to what I was saying about this nuanced view of long-term incentive modifiers versus the short-term negotiation tools, I think it'll be in specific sectors that where you might see lasting inflationary effects, but not all sectors. That's my opinion. And then the other thing is, I think Bob touched upon oil, or Joseph touched upon oil. I think that's a critical input, because in 2021, you know, it was basically high oil prices that led to the dollar wrecking ball in 2022. And I think that by getting oil down, and by the way, I don't think the oil bear is done. I think we're going to see oil in the 40s before all is said and done. It's hard for me to see a runaway inflation situation with $40 oil. And so when it comes down to Powell, I've been saying that, you know, I've been a big critic of Powell for being pusillanimous Powell for his December 23 rhetorical pivot, and then his premature pivot in September, when he really had no reason to squander all those bullets so early. But now I kind of side with Joseph that, you know, at least now there is a modicum of uncertainty with respect to unemployment and the economic outlook. And now it seems like he's squandered a lot of bullets when he should actually. So I say that, you know, pusillanimous Powell has all of a sudden transitioned to parsimonious Powell, which is, you know, it looks kind of political to me. That said, I'm a supporter of Fed independence, and I think Trump needs to just shut up about that. But I do think that there's much more of a case for easing now than when he actually started cutting.
Thank you, Michael. So we've touched a little bit on jobs, so I do want to take a little detour into the topic of jobs. The April jobs report showed 177,000 new positions, but those are mostly concentrated in healthcare. And in addition to that, somewhat in line with what Jim was saying, with the we might see that pop in employment, unemployment itself as a whole is still stuck at 4.2%. Now, would this be considered kind of a solid jobs market, or are we seeing the beginning of softening just below the surface? I want to go last bear on this one and then kick her around.
Yeah, well, I would say on employment, what you've seen is we went from probably the tightest labor market, maybe ever in 2022, with the bounce back and shortage of workers. And that has continued to sort of come down and ease consistently for the past 3 years. And in one way that kind of, because it's consistently eased and it hasn't been a problem for markets or the economy overall, we've looked at that as broadly a normalization. And I think that there is normalization elements going on there. But at the same time, we haven't seen an inflection, a stabilization or inflection upwards. I would say maybe a little bit in the fall of this past year, it seemed like there was some positive indications on you know, job openings and hiring rates. But I think that's kind of come off again a little bit in the past couple months. The ADP numbers, which I think personally, I think are a little bit better than the BLS numbers, have shown weakness in the past 3 months. So I think that we still are in sort of a structurally tight labor market, but it's one that's absolutely weaker than it was, a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And to the extent that there are impacts on exports or imports or just broader business uncertainty, that could continue to deteriorate. So I kind of view, at the same time on the inflation side, I know people have mixed impressions about trueflation numbers, but over a long time, you know, they do, even if they don't match month to month, they sort of do follow the same trend as BLS reports. And those numbers continue to look really low. And I think part of that is the energy dynamic. There's also an element here with, export volumes declining, which could actually decrease food prices or food staple prices in the U.S. domestically. And I do think that it might be appropriate. I don't think that anything's going to happen in the next 2 minutes, but maybe in coming months that we could see further cuts.
So still on that same topic here, I know we got about 2 minutes. So once we get the data drop, we can obviously pause, take a look at the dot plots, talk about that before we come back to this. But still in line with that aspect of jobs, wage growth itself has basically flattened out recently. And we're still obviously seeing prices rise almost across the board, groceries, goods. Does that mean workers are about to feel another sort of squeeze with prices rising and wages maintaining a flat line? Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the point about whether, let's say, tariffs do persist for an extended period of time, and the prices of the relevant goods rise, you know, how much are we going to see a rise in inflation versus of overall inflation, let's say, versus demand destruction, which will result in weaker growth? And, you know, I think it really comes down to the wage environment sort of market, and probably more so than any other indicator that what really matters is we're seeing a deceleration in wage growth, which means that there's less nominal spending power for households to continue to buy. And so that's a pretty different story when, you know, incomes were growing pretty rapidly on a nominal basis and were supplemented by government transfers during the first bout of inflation. We're basically on the other side of that equation with a deteriorating labor market today. And that really suggests that it's much more likely that the supply chain disruptions and the price rises of particular goods will lead to a broader demand destruction in real terms rather than a broad-based price rise. It might be measured that way, but the economic effect would be contractionary as a function of that, in the same way a traditional supply-side shock is often contractionary economically if it happens, you know, in an acute way.
Thank you, Bob. Now, hot off the press here, before we circle back, the Fed Reserve, kind of as expected here, has not cut rates and keeps holding that benchmark lending rate steady at a range of 4.25 to 4.5%. So I'm just going to give the panelists a little time here to look over the release and digest the data a little bit. So kind of while you're reading through, folks, feel free to jump in with any commentary.
I would just say that, you know, the commentary is very even-handed from the Fed. They talk about that the unemployment rate has stabilized, market conditions remain solid, inflation somewhat elevated. So again, they're not at least publicly expressing concern over weakness.
This is a statement that suggests that they should not do anything anytime soon. And they're creating room for that, particularly in stating that the risks of both higher unemployment and higher inflation. And so they're giving themselves cover to do nothing for some time, it seems.
Yeah, it seems like the highlight is increased uncertainty. So the Fed didn't know what to do last time, and even more today don't know what to do.
Parsimonious Powell.
So just kind of on the surface here, do we see this as continuation of just testing the waters over time, being a little less reactive, or are we still seeing too much, for lack of a better word, too much of a conservative take on whether they cut or not?
I think that there's also an element of fighting the last battle here. Obviously, you know, the Fed was arguably quite late to the last inflation battle and arguably turbocharged it in its early stages. And so I think that that's combined with the political element and trying to maintain neutrality is a element here. Whereas if we didn't just experience a significant, really significant period of inflation, I think that there'd be a whole lot more caution on the side of the Fed.
I think that's a good point. We did have large inflation recently. But then at the same time, last year, we did see them cut preemptively when everything was fine. Stocks were high. Economy was growing strongly. Cut 50 basis points preemptively. And then now just kind of totally changed that policy. I don't think that's a good look for the Fed.
On the contrary, could it be perceived as, hey, maybe we made the wrong move. We should be more cautious moving forward. Like, is it inherently a bad look, I guess I would say? Does it instill the lack of confidence in those paying attention to policy, or does it show the Fed's willingness to adjust based on new factors that come to light?
I think it shows that Jay Powell is the master of skating to where the puck was 5 minutes ago, because he's also the same Jay Powell that basically was buying $100 billion of MBS as NFTs were going to the moon. So...
And housing scoring 20% year over year and price increases too. That was a really strange policy choice back then.
I think the challenge here is, let's say there was no tariff situation going on. And to be clear, the markets are pricing as if, you know, in 60 days, it'll all be gone. The economy absent the tariff risks and some of the negative, you know, marginal negative growth efforts by the new administration, are, you know, is fine. Like, as Joseph said, kind of at the top of this, you know, real final sales in the first quarter was 3%. It's been 3% for 2 years. 3% is pretty good. And so that really is a challenge to basically be like, well, we could either go down a path in the next 3 months of continued strength, for which there's no real reason to do anything with rates. And to be frank, there was no real reason to do anything with rates, you know, in the fall either, but, you know, that's water under the bridge, I guess. Or we're going to have an incredibly detrimental economic supply shock that, you know, could drive the economy into recession and drive inflation higher. You know, that's a pretty tough, tough call to make, let's say, in terms of which one you do. And so I think the only thing that you can do in that situation, the only reasonable path is to do nothing.
So kind of spinning us here, there was a brief mention here on that topic of housing. So I want to touch on that and see if we're kind of looking at, you know, kind of a turning point in the housing market, or if we're looking at more of a temporary reset in the housing market. So inventory's up 30% year over year, I think it was, while pending sales dropped 3.2% in April alone. So is this early stages of a real reset, or is this just, you know, buyers hitting pause because of those high interest rates? Let's hit last bear on this, and then please, anybody feel free to chime in.
So I think for real estate, you can't really look at the whole country as a total. You have to look at regional dynamics because they are very, very, very different right now. So in places like Florida and Texas and sort of the area that probably saw the highest level of appreciation and net migration in the early days of COVID, also places where there's ample land to develop and build new housing. Those are the markets that you see sort of really significant increases in inventory even over last year, and could see a little bit more of a correction. But if you look at places like in the Northeast, inventory is a fraction of what it was before COVID. But it is interesting also, at one point as it relates to inflation, there's the new tenant rent index, which just a point on the data here. The most recent data points always seem to look way too low and get revised higher. So I'm removing the most recent data point. But even still, if you were to look at the trend over the past year, those rental rates are now going below where they were in the prior decade. So continuing to go down as you see rental vacancies increase overall on a national level. You had a ton of new supply, especially in multifamily, come in the past couple of years. You have migration slowing down significantly under Trump, that reduces demand for housing. So I do think that there are signs of slowdown for sure in the housing market. And the housing market is just, you know, it's not like the stock market where you have 20% down in a month and a V-shaped recovery. If you think back to like 2008, which obviously is an extreme example, but housing prices peaked in 2006-07 and they bottomed in 2012. You're talking about years for this market to reset. And I think with that, for much of the country, we've been in a period of, you know, freeze effectively because people can't afford new mortgages. Nobody wants to move. At the same time, there's a new premium on housing based on remote work and all these kind of things. And so it's been in this sort of, Titanic freeze zone that maybe will start to loosen up in certain areas. And I think places like Florida and Texas and the Gulf Coast area are places where you might see more of a real correction. I don't think that you're going to see as much of a downside, but maybe just a pause in price increases elsewhere in sort of the Northeast and Midwest.
You know, to your point, Last Bear, so back in February, I wrote a piece, actually it was part of my interview with Maggie Lake, talking about the deflationary versus the inflationary components of the Trump 2.0 playbook. And, you know, the deflationary aspects are, you know, the deregulation, cost cutting, agency purges, getting oil down. And then inflationary, at least by consensus, were the deportations, tariffs, tax cuts, deglobalization. But as you point out, and as I pointed out in my piece, The deportations and the tariffs are both a double-edged sword. Tariffs, we already talked about the demand destruction components, but the deportations, as you point out, right, while it reduces the labor pool, it also reduces housing demand. So I wrote in that piece that, you know, I think that on balance, I see the Trump 2.0 playbook as net-net deflationary. And you know, the in my oil piece about you know what kind of conditions would it take to have sustainably lower rates and a weaker dollar? I think that low oil in and of itself is a necessary but insufficient condition for that to be accomplished. But I do think that perhaps when you take the rest of the Trump 2.0 playbook in its entirety, they might produce those sufficient conditions. The jury is out on that, obviously.
So I just point out that the price action now is, equities are selling off and it looks like bonds are rallying. So, I mean, if it's just the Fed, that would suggest some kind of growth concern. But I think we also have headlines coming out about Trump's discussion on China, saying that he wouldn't lower tariffs ahead of time. So that could be part of it as well. But I've also learned that on these days you have all sorts of options activity. So I don't know if Jim has any insight, if there's any, positioning around options around now that could be skewing interpretations of the Fed.
So the big thing, big takeaway here is on the options space is we had all this weekend uncertainty that was just created yesterday, right? I think that's a big deal here. You know, everybody's wondering what is this big deal that's coming this weekend? You know, what is the big positive news, the deal? And the reality is they aren't explaining anything. They're just leaving a kind of big uncertain question mark there. You got to wonder if it's the administration trying to get in front of the fact that the Fed's not cutting and that the market's likely to not take this very well. But there is this vol pump that happened for Monday, you know, really coming in last night into today, and that's creating kind of a short gamma situation in the short term. Interestingly, the 12th vol was like the one vol that was kind of available across the board in options land. It was a gamma that was really hedging out the May OPEX. Behind that, you have the 13th, which is obviously CPI. And as I mentioned, one of the top things we're talking about on here in the big debate, you know, there's a lot of you guys, myself, all disagree. There's a lot of uncertainty about what the inflation numbers are going to look like. And so the 12th, the 13th, and you have May OPEX, and then you kind of have a bunch of vol risk behind that in a June quarterly OPEX. And quarterly OPEXs are always some of the most dangerous. So the big story here in terms of positioning and flows is that the supply of vol and all of the things that led to kind of the Vonage support into this window and the bounce back to the one half standard deviation of the 20-day, the 50-day moving average, all the things that we said would happen here off the bottom is now going away. And so the big story is vol is no longer offered, gamma is in short supply, and the market is slowly becoming unpinned here.
So, with about 15 minutes until Jerome takes the podium, I want to touch a little bit on that topic of treasuries, the bond markets. In April, the 10-year treasury yield, which, as we know, is a hot topic when we're discussing recessionary pressures, inflation, the economy as a whole, the 10-year jumped, I think, 3.99% to 4.5% just in April alone. And so my question to this is, especially looking at their reaction today, is this reactionary to inflation nerves, or are we seeing some kind of deeper shift in the global trust in the U.S. fiscal policy? Let's start with Bob here, and then I'd like to get Michael and Lasbear in on this one as well.
Well, I'll take a position that's contrary to many of the most extreme doomers that, you know, the bond market is likely to trade consistent with sort of its normal, particularly growth-oriented behavior, meaning that, you know, when growth dynamics are going to be weaker, that they'll probably rally, in particular relative to stocks, and similarly the opposite direction. And so, and circumstances like today, even the rally period in stocks looked more like, you know, stocks rallying relative to bonds. And then similarly, we've had a bit of a rollover there. The bid for bonds, you know, of course, there's the corner case that a bunch of reserve managers decide to sell out their reserve holdings in order to punish the U.S. But the odds that that's going to happen, or even if it does, the odds that you're not going to get a bid from domestic demand in one form or another, particularly if the yield curve steepens, you know, is pretty low. And so I think in some ways, you know, and then ultimately, if the yield curve steepened or rates went to a level that was unacceptable from the Fed's perspective, they could, of course, start buying the bonds and bringing yields down. And so I think all of these things are effectively emphasizing that there's much more of a put in bonds than there is a put in stocks. Because ultimately, you know, bonds in many ways, so, you know, bond yields, any bond yield rise, particularly relative to conditions, sows the seeds of an inevitable rally as economic conditions will and asset prices deteriorate in a way that for stocks is totally different. Stock falls are self-reinforcing to the downside. And so I just keep that in mind. My guess is, you know, bonds are going to continue to be a pretty good diversifier, not a pretty bad diversifier on a forward-looking basis.
So as a go ahead, Jim.
I want to highlight one important thing on the bond side. Everybody seems to think the 40 will hedge the 60 again. Guess what? It's not going to work again. This has been something we've talked about on here for 4 to 5 years. Why? Because inflation is not going away. I just want to be clear. Inflation is not going away. And it's actually excelled, but the issues and the structural things that have caused it now for four years are only getting accelerated. We are spending more. I want to highlight, we are spending more than the last 8 years and 12 years and everything else we talked about, right? We're spending more and we're cutting supply to companies. We have a bi-pronged inflationary pressure that all of a sudden nobody seems to appreciate. Everybody's just focused on recession, recession, recession. Everybody's focusing on the wrong side. By the way, I'm not saying we're not going into recession. I am not saying that we won't get some incremental slowdown. I'm saying the inflation part of the stagflation is much more important right now. And that's what the Fed is talking about. That's why the Fed's not moving. Again, we can debate whether or not that taking money from the top 10% and giving it to the bottom 40% is GDP, hurts GDP or not. Yes, it will probably slow things down because we're taking generally more away. But the amount of actual spending likely won't decrease that much. Corporate profits may decrease. You may get an earnings recession, but at the end of the day, the issue is not revenue decreases for companies. The issue is profit decreases. And the difference there is that remains inflationary. And so I don't agree at all that the long end of the curve is somehow going to save you from an equity deterioration. Now, that doesn't mean the long end of the curve is going, the yields are going higher. But it does mean, to be clear, that it's not going to give you the protection you need in an equity sector.
Last bear, I saw you had a little reaction there as well. Did you have a comment before I pass to Michael?
No, you could pass. I was just encouraging the point about the points that Jim was making.
Fair enough. Michael, go ahead.
I think the crux of our disagreement here is really what happens to inflation longer term. And you know, as a result, I mean, I outlined my reasons for why I think that I actually think that inflation will get tamed by a slowdown. So if anything, gun to my head, I actually expect a bigger likelihood of a flattener than a steepener. And just to say something about, the hyperventilation about the sell everything US related hyperbole that we've been hearing, I do think that a lot of that has to do with animus towards Trump. But that said, memories are short in the market and rate differentials will rule the day. So when you look at whether it's the 2 year or the 10 year, rate diffs right now are, I think, going to lend support to both the US dollar and to longer duration bond markets. And just one last comment, just to put things into perspective, the 10 year today is actually 2 basis points inside of where it was back in on November 4th. So for all the, sell everything US, sell the dollar, sell US bonds, sell US equities, I think a lot of that is just hyperbolic.
So to kind of tie on to that, Bob, I see your hand and I would love your comments in addition to your answer to this. Do we think we're heading into a higher rate world for the long haul, or will we see some normalization amidst the bond markets once inflation and the geopolitics situation kind of cool off?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main question is, in the event that we see a weakening of economic conditions, what does the Fed prioritize? And in that case, I think the sort of traditional emerging market balance of payments framework is a pretty bad framework, one that many people are sort of looking to in terms of the sell everything in the US context. And the reason why that is because while the US is significantly reliant on foreign capital, and particularly reliant on unhedged equity foreign capital in the last 10 years, the choices, given the fact that debts are in, dollars, and that the US economy is a large, diversified, mostly domestically oriented economy, the choice for the Fed is very clear, which is you respond to domestic economic conditions in your policy pursuits. And what that means is if you have weakening economic conditions, you cut interest rates. And there's nothing about, and the trade-off there is that you'll have a weaker dollar. So if you think that there's a sell everything US trade that's likely to occur, you're in much better shape going long bonds relative to stocks and short the dollar than going short bonds relative to cash. It's a much higher probability trade focusing on US stocks on a relative basis, short US stocks on a relative basis to the rest of the world, than focusing on bonds. Because ultimately, if it plays out, if it plays out that way, that there is capital being pulled out of the US, the bond market is not going to feel the effect. It is not going to feel the pain over the long term, because the Fed will deliver the policy appropriate for domestic conditions.
Thank you, Bob. So we've got about 6 minutes left, but I am wondering, on the topic of the US dollar, on the topic of US debt, Japan specifically has been buying more US debt. But on the other hand, China's been somewhat quietly cutting back. And I'm wondering, does that say anything about how the world sees our economic stability right now? Let's go Joseph, then Last Bear.
So I think Bob makes a really good point in that, in this framework, in the future, if we would have economic trouble, Fed will cut rates, and what you would sacrifice is the currency. Now, that actually has a big impact on whether or not foreigners are interested in holding U.S. assets. So let's say going forward, the U.S., the Fed will act in a way that, buffers the domestic economy at the expense of the currency. Then if you are a foreign investor, you're going to get currency losses on those U.S. assets. And so that, I think that impacts demand for U.S. assets. and could, I think, on the surface look like a sell America trade. So maybe part of the reason that foreigners seem to be less interested in dollar assets is that they're afraid that going forward we will have a dollar weakness or depreciation, and that would impact their returns in local currency.
I'll add a couple comments about this, because this is a topic near and dear to my heart. So 2 years ago, I co-authored a paper that we presented at West Point that talked about US dollar primacy in an era of economic warfare, really examining the pillars of national power that ultimately determine both dollar strength and dollar adoption, right? Those are two often conflated issues. And what makes the dollar a global reserve is a whole host of pillars of national power. It's not just about debt to GDP, which is a singular stock to flow metric. You have to also consider the quality of the U.S. Asset side of the national balance sheet that no one ever talks about. And then, of course, when you talk about the history of the U.S. dollar and the evolution of the Eurodollar market, it came about because at that time, the U.S. was the upstart superpower relative to Great Britain. Now, you could argue that, yes, we are, the current liberal world order is fragmenting into a more multipolar state. But the difference this time is that there is no upstart that surpasses the U.S. in all elements of national power. China is attempting to, at least on the military side, but they're nowhere on the cultural side, and even on the economic side, they're still not there. And so I think ultimately also a key prerequisite is for the dollar ecosystem is to have a deep and liquid and supply elastic sovereign bond market. The EU doesn't even have one. China doesn't have one. China has, and furthermore, China has a closed capital account. So there is no fiat alternative to a reserve asset relative to the U.S. Treasury bond. Now, what about gold? Well, if you look at China, right, a lot of this hyperbolic move in gold has been because China is in this unenviable state of not wanting to increase its reserves of U.S. treasuries, but they have very few places to go, and they're basically plowing money into a supply inelastic asset. Well, that's great if on the way up, but I always like to say the sort of supply inelasticity cuts both ways. What happens when the PBOC needs to actually sell those reserve assets? Well, if they're primarily in gold, then you can have a very, very severe decline. You could have like a multi-$100-day decline in gold if that shifts. So that's the problem. So I don't see the U.S. dollar or the U.S. Treasury market going anywhere relative to its share of global adoption, really.
Thank you, Michael. Last Bear, Joseph, Bob, and Jem. Last Bear, do you have one last comment before we kick the listeners over to J-Pal?
I'll just say super quickly, just on U.S. versus rest of the world, think about relative value as well. So U.S., when we talk about markets, people thought that China was uninvestable a year ago. Now it's significantly outperformed S&P. Earnings yield in Europe is still significantly higher than what you get in the U.S. So relative value matters on that front. But I'll leave it at that. And I know you're going into exits. So I would just say you can follow me here on Twitter and follow my Substack if you're interested. Thanks.
And thank you, everybody. If you're not following these folks, get on that. I learned more from the panelists we have on these FOMC panels than I learned in the last 10, 15 years of life. They're just so crucial to staying on top of things that are happening in macroeconomics. I can't thank them enough. Thanks for coming, everybody, and I hope the rest of your day is less of a roller coaster than the markets are right now. Take care, everybody.